This week on the Gary Hour.
Probably his most famous thought experiment. It's in an essay called Famine and Affluence, and it's this concept of the shallow pools. So it's the idea that if you were walking down the street and you saw a child drowning in a shallow pool, and you could kind of step in and save this child, you'd be required to. He pointed out that you know, where we are now, when we know so much about the world, and we know that there are children that are effectively in the same position, and that for a nominal amount of money, we could save someone from dying.
G, 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 take me away.
Welcome to episode 93 of the Gary Hour. I'm your host, Gary Levitt. This week, I talk to Chris Corliss, who is one of the members of a group, or shall I say movement, called Effective Altruism. I came out of this conversation feeling less guilty than I thought I was going to feel, and actually pretty hopeful. So I hope you get the same effect. This episode is brought to you by Future Moments, makers of mobile apps for content creation. If you're a musician, a podcaster, voiceover artist, go to the App Store and search for Future Moments, because they have an app that'll make your life easier and your production so much better. Okay, thank you for listening, and for those of you that left some new reviews, that is awesome. Please do that. And enjoy. Chris Corliss.
How are you doing?
I'm like, wait, you are Chris, right? Awesome. So you're involved with this group called Effective Altruism.
Yeah, that's right.
Organization, should I say.
Yeah, I mean, I think people refer to it as a movement. So you can think of it as analogous to something like feminism, where there's no, you know, strict organizational structure. There's no, you know, declared leader or anything like that. It's a group of people that share, you know, common beliefs and are active in trying to promote those.
Uh-huh. Are you looking to take over?
You know, I made a stab, but it didn't.
So Effective Altruism, I'm just going to read a little bit off of Wikipedia.
Okay.
To give listeners a definition. So it says on Wikipedia, and you can correct this if wrong, because apparently anyone could post anything on Wikipedia.
Yeah.
So it says, Effective Altruism is a philosophy and social movement that uses evidence and reasoning to determine the most effective ways to benefit others.
Mm-hmm.
Does that sound right?
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think there's a component that is maybe missing there, that it's figuring those ways out and then acting on them, actually going ahead and doing it, you know?
So it's basically a charity, but a smart charity. So I wouldn't just give my money to a crackhead that passes by me, because that's probably not the best use of my charity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think the movement incorporates aspects that are charity. I think it's not necessarily dependent that it be, or you know, something be organized as a charity. You know, I think the word altruism and effective altruism, you know, the work that it's doing there is basically saying that these are you know, things that we're interested in for the benefits of others and to improve the world in the best way that we can.
Right. So you want to improve the world.
Yes. Yeah. And so, you know, the point is like, yeah, there might be for-profits that do that.
But this organization is not for profit.
So I wouldn't think of it as an organization.
Right.
There are many organizations within the umbrella movement.
Mm-hmm.
And there are kind of central organizing groups that try to figure out problems that a lot of that have, you know, wide impact. But it's a very kind of dispersed type of movement, so if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. So, it's all over the world, right?
Yeah.
There's meetings people can go to?
Yes, yeah. So for example, a good example is this Effective Altruism NYC, which is kind of my entree into actually being kind of more hands-on with Effective Altruism. You know, that didn't come down from any sanctioned type of group. That was something that people were interested in Effective Altruism, and they said, okay, let's make a meetup group for people to get together and discuss this.
Right. So what are some things that have been done as a result?
So, I think if you look at early pieces of Effective Altruism, I think early in the day, there was a focus that I think has shifted since of people donating in the most effective way. So finding these best charities, if I have $1,000 to donate, how can I give that to an effective charity that's going to save the most lives or improve the most lives with that money? And so some of the early things that kind of got a lot of media attention were people who decided, I could go and be an aid worker. This is the kind of, I'm interested in global development, but I actually think that if I go and be a banker, I can make more money and I could hire 5 aid workers in my stead. And so, that's something that was done very kind of early in the movement.
I like that. So that means you can work at some job, say you don't even really enjoy being a banker.
Mm-hmm.
But you want to give back to the world.
Yeah.
So you sacrifice yourself in that job as a way to give back. So really, it's good to be passionate about your job, but you might not be directly passionate about banking, but you could be directly passionate about the work, the charity you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
So that could fuel your work.
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
Is that what happens with some members?
I think so. Yeah. I mean, I think, like I said, folks have moved a little bit away from that for a couple of reasons. One, it's sort of a very simplified toy model of kind of how these things work.
Uh-huh.
And it doesn't necessarily think about kind of a full life cycle of someone's career, where is that realistic that someone's going to spend, those 20, 30, 40 years behind the desk at this job they hate, and a lot of kind of the payoff at the end of that is your latent career money that you'll be donating to these charities. So it's definitely something that I think it captures a couple things that are somewhat core to the movement, which is really separating the way that you are approaching helping people from the help that you're giving them. And just to kind of, provide an example for that, I think a lot of people, if you look at a charity, they say, what I want to do is help education globally. And I think Effective Altruism takes a step back from that and says, I want to do the most good that I can globally. And whether that be in education or global health or, some other cause areas, really taking a wide open view at the best thing you can do.
Yeah, it could be tricky when choosing a charity, because there's unfortunately a lot of charities that you might give a dollar and 80 cents goes to the charity to pay the CEO, to pay all the people that are working for the charity.
Mm-hmm.
And then by the time that money trickles down, there's 20 cents going to the actual people you thought you were giving to.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So they have groups out there like Charity Navigator. I'm not sure if you're familiar with this.
What's Charity Navigator?
This is kind of a charity evaluation, let's call it 1.0, where they provide some sort of star rating to see how much is spent on overhead and how much is spent on.
Is there an app that people can kind of pull up and see?
I would not recommend that that one. It doesn't dig too much into that.
Because the app costs money?
well. Here's where I'm getting with this is that so that all that overhead, definitely is an aspect of loss. So if they're using it for marketing, but one kind of crucial consideration is that some of the actual cause areas are so much more effective than others that you could waste 95% of the money on overhead and still do more good with your money. And so the kind of cornerstone charity evaluator within Effective Altruism is a group called GiveWell. Mm-hmm. These guys were working at a hedge fund, Bridgewater.
Yeah.
And they were looking for places to donate and get get evidence backed donations to, you know, with their bonuses at the end of the year. And they were online and they said, you know, there's really not any good information that's really going to tell us what actually happens with the money and what are the actual end results of this.
Right.
And so they effectively left the hedge fund and started this evaluator, which analyzes charities kind of in a similar way to really look at impact as the, you know, the main criteria.
Right. That's called GiveWell?
GiveWell, yes. So these guys, all one word.
All one word. Yeah. So these guys, how modern?
Yeah, right.
So these guys must have taken a big pay cut, huh? They went from a hedge fund to...
I can't. I got to imagine some of their friends from work are living a little higher than they are right now.
How did you get involved with this?
You know, I think when you talk to people who are involved with effective altruism, a lot of them will say that this is sort of a way that they've thought for a long time, and that hearing about this was really just putting a name to something that they had already thought and were already, a way that they were, already thinking of the world. So
right, it just kind of simplified it and like
effective altruism. It's like, oh yeah, that's what I believe. Yeah.
Right. So
I let's see, like my background, I went to, Wisconsin and I studied economics and I was interested in, you know, some of the ways of, you know, measuring how the world has gotten better and how different things like technologies and capital investment are able to build up and, you know, make it so we don't have to dig ditches and we can just do podcasts these days, you know, so like, you know, these things are making the world better.
Right. You could say I'm doing my part right now.
You're really, seriously, yeah.
Because I don't really feel like getting on a plane and going to dig a ditch in some country. I mean, there might not be Wi-Fi in that country.
Yeah. Yeah, certainly, definitely not this great audio setup we got here. I like this.
So I would never go. This is my part. No, I'm just kidding.
So anyways, I was interested in that. And then one of the first things I think that really had a vein of effective altruism in it was something called the Copenhagen Consensus. This was a conference that was run by the Danish environmental minister and co-sponsored by The Economist magazine. And it basically got a bunch of economists together and said, let's say you had a notional $100 million to invest globally. What would be the best area to invest it? So they had a bunch of proposals and they ranked them. And I don't know if it was through this. I went back through my email, and my brother, I think, was the first person to refer me to GiveWell, because I had talked to him about this Copenhagen Consensus. And so GiveWell, that charity evaluator, they then, in one of their blog posts, mentioned effective altruism.
That's how you found out about
and
it?
That's where I first heard about it.
What do you think motivated you to even pursue charity work?
I mean, I always joke it's the old ex-Catholic guilt, you know.
Raised Catholic.
Yeah, but you know, I mean, I think it's, you know, these types of frameworks that you get as a kid for thinking about, you know, what's important in life and what does it mean to be a good person, and having those types of discussions with, you know, my brother or friends, just kind of these long walks of, you know, arguing and, walking along in the woods, just arguing with each other.
Yeah.
These types of things are kind of, I think, the source of, you know, where that comes from.
Because I don't feel like it is very mainstream America to even think about charity.
Yeah, maybe not. I mean, I think people give a lot. I mean, they, I think a lot of it, if you look at, you know, stuff that goes to churches and goes to local health organizations or goes to, you know, the bake sale and things like that, you know, it's out there in society.
So maybe it's just my friends.
It's my, yeah, I definitely think New York, no, they don't care about that. It's like, they're not trying to hear that, man.
Yeah, New York is not really. I mean, America, United States in general is like work and amass a wealth.
Mm-hmm.
And, unless you grew up religious, you kind of don't hear too much about charity.
Mm, yeah, I think that's about right. I mean,
and it doesn't have to be bound with religion.
No. I mean, I think it's something that it almost is intractably bound with some things that feels like religion. When you start having these conversations, there's just these really deep-seated beliefs, you know, that you're touching on. And that's one of the things I think is most interesting about being involved with Effective Altruism, is that you meet people who have really thought long and hard about a lot of philosophical and practical issues that never really crossed your mind, you know?
Right.
And so every time you're talking to someone, they have some new kind of insight. But that, you know, that's very challenging. And, you know, when I talk to my friends sometimes, you'll get in, you know, these arguments where one guy's arguing with you about, you know, something about Kantian thing, which negates my theory. And somebody else says aid doesn't work in Africa. And somebody else says, give local. And, you know, you're having these five different, you know, arguments at the same time. And,
right. It's almost like instead of religious wars, if everyone was atheist, they'd be fighting over who is more atheist or something.
Exactly. Yeah.
So effective altruism is basically it's a philosophy.
Yeah, there are aspects of philosophy to it. Yeah. And it's, you know, it's founded by philosophers.
I read.
So Will, go ahead.
Will Peter Singer?
Yeah. Peter Singer is kind of the intellectual godfather of the movement, let's call it. So one of his probably his most famous thought experiment, it's in an essay called Famine and Affluence, and it's this concept of the shallow pools. So it's the idea that if you were walking down the street and you saw a child drowning in a shallow pool, and you could kind of step in and save this child, you'd be required to.
Right.
Even if you were walking down the street and you were going to an important interview and you were late for the interview and you had expensive shoes on or a suit and you were going to ruin that, you couldn't say, well, you know, I was pretty late. I didn't really want to save this drowning child.
And we've actually, governments have made a law that you would have to.
I think in certain jurisdictions, yes.
Yeah, if you didn't, you could be brought up on manslaughter or whatever the charge would be.
Yeah, I think that's right. So he pointed out that you know, where we are now, when we know so much about the world, and we know that there are children that are effectively in the same position, and that for a nominal amount of money, we could save someone from dying. Like we could save a child from dying.
Yikes.
And so, you know, is there a way to justify that, that we would be, you know, have to save this child if it's right next to us, and then versus, you know, this child, you know, potentially in a developing country.
Oof, where do you draw the line?
And where do you draw the line? Now, I tend to draw the line on we're all just evil. I mean, like, not evil, but, like, you know, we're all falling short of what we should be doing.
You do feel that way?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I feel like I've just, I don't know how much I've come to terms with it versus just ignore it. But, you know, there's, you know, I think I have a tough time rationalizing that thought experiment in any other way, I guess. I don't know.
Well, yeah, and it's interesting that this came up here because we're pretty much in the heart of New York City, near Canal Street, and literally right outside of the window is a homeless shelter or food bank or something. So especially living in New York City, there you see a different form of a baby drowning in a puddle.
Mm-hmm.
Every other block.
Yeah.
And you can't live in New York City without desensitizing yourself to that. And you can't possibly help each and every one of them.
Mm-hmm.
There's just not enough time. Maybe there's not enough money. And there's a lot of times there's nothing you can do about it.
Well, yeah. And I think that's definitely true. I mean, I think one of the things that blows my mind is that these folks that you're seeing right outside your door are actually, you know, probably somewhere in the global middle class. You know, they're kind of like lower middle class globally. And that the level of poverty that's experienced globally is just so much more intense. You know, something like 17% of the world's population, so like a billion people, are living on less than $2 a day. And this is $2 a day adjusted for, you know, the cost of living there. So it's basically what you could buy with $2 per day in New York or in an American city.
Right. So what you're saying is the poorest person in the United States is still probably like a pretty wealthy person in some other countries.
Yeah, I think that's, I mean, it's somewhat right. I mean, I think, you know, I wouldn't, I wouldn't want to get too deep into that, you know, that argument, because I think there are a lot of people that, well, let me say this, and this will kind of key onto another concept that's, I think, really important, is the type of poverty in the U.S. that's like that is not very tractable. So tractability is kind of a concept that means, can we actually do something that will change that, or that will have that have impact? And I think within the United States, the poverty that would be at that level is likely associated with mental health issues. It's associated with substance abuse issues. It's it's really kind of a tricky problem.
Right.
Whereas in the developing world, you have this poverty that just exists kind of in kind of large swaths,
like straight up famine kind of thing.
The ability to make relatively low cost health interventions, for example, that will have a lot of impact. So some of the charities that are promoted for helping humans are things in global health, like anti-malarial bed nets, deworming. One of the interesting charities is something called Give Directly, which uses mobile payment systems, just directly send money to the poorest people in the world that have access to these mobile payment systems.
How do they get that?
They typically will do things like they'll have one phone across 100 people in a community, and able to send to that.
I think it was Bill and Melinda Gates talking about this.
Yeah.
Yep. Is that possible?
Yep. Okay. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So it's definitely a hot topic, and the kind of order of development is happening at a different place there, where there's no running water, but there's access to cell phones.
So that's a good example of effective altruism. They set up this mobile system where anybody can open their phone, mm-hmm. and give,
and to, can give directly directly to the poorer people. Now, one of the things that they try to do is always, because effective altruism is really focused on evidence and reason, and so they try to incorporate a lot of follow-up studies and get a lot of data about what's actually happening in the communities. And this is something I really like about the movement, is that there's a lot of leeway, or people are very comfortable relative to my normal experience with saying, okay, that thing that I thought before was wrong, and now I'm going to change my mind. And
wait, people are admitting they're wrong?
It's nuts. It's like, half the time you can't even get their opinion out of them, because they're like, well, I'm not an expert in this. There's a lot of qualifiers. Yeah. So like, right. There's just an intellectual honesty about the thing. Yeah.
Yeah. There's a certain, you were saying about Peter Singer, and I was really interested in that philosophy. Did I cut that off? Cause that was pretty interesting.
So, I think that this thought experiment, this drowning pool.
I just like the idea of a thought experiment. That was the exact words that stuck with me.
Yeah. That's something that I think kind of sat there, and it was kind of that example is something that gets taught in, ethics 101, and it's kind of presented as like, oh, this is a really interesting thing. Like, whoa, mind blown,
Yeah. It makes you feel immediately guilty.
Yeah. You feel like, and then you're like reaching for ways to sort that out. I think, well, basically it was picked up and, folks like Will McCaskill and Toby Ord and, Robin Wilbin said, why don't we actually do something with this, So why don't we actually follow this to its logical conclusion and, actually take action to square our lives a little more with what we should be living up to. And that's kind of the origin of... some of this thinking anyway.
It is. So they're all, these meetups are all over the world or just the country?
So they're most, I forget what the last survey is. It's online somewhere, but the UK, Australia, the United States, are probably the biggest, groups. Germany has some folks, France, Canada.
Is the Gates Foundation aware of this?
I believe they are. Yeah. So they're. I think of them as a fairly effective group. I think that they are. I don't know how much they have been really hands-on, you know, and really kind of coordinated with any of the effective altruism people. But
they did go on some pretty mainstream television shows and talk about this mobile system.
Yes, yeah. So they're like they have a lot of overlap. So they're, you know, let's cure malaria. Let's do this and yeah. So I think there's a lot of overlap. You know, they also do things like fund U.S. schools. Which I think is, noble, but I don't think there are many EAs who think that's the highest use of the marginal dollar to.
So our EAs.
Oh, that's the that's the shorthand.
Yeah, I picked up that acronym.
Get ready for some more. Yeah.
Okay. Cool. So yeah, these days we got to be aware of all the acronyms.
Yeah. Yeah.
So if you are looking to help the most needy.
Yeah.
I guess most of your work wouldn't even be done in this country.
I think that's true. And, I think also a lot of effective altruists would argue that a lot of your work wouldn't even be done with people who are alive today. So there are two other main cause areas, aside from global poverty, that receive most of the attention. One of those is animal suffering.
So this is not only human.
Definitely not only human. So, okay.
So does that mean effective altruists are vegetarian?
There's a strong thread of caring about animal suffering, animal rights, within the movement. Part of the reason is, Peter Singer also wrote a book, Animal Liberation. So he was a very early advocate, in philosophy for the idea that there's not really many things that separate humans and other species that would justify the way that we treat animals, especially in commercial agriculture. Industrial agriculture is some pretty rough, the pretty rough truths about what's going on there, you know? So it's another area where he pointed out kind of this, inconsistency. And, you know, there are different ways that people, address that. They say, animals can't talk and they don't have this or that, but there aren't really, for a lot of people, they don't think that there are really justifiable ones. In other words, if a person were unable to talk, if the section of their brain got popped out that, you wouldn't say, okay, let's put them in a cage and grind them up. Yeah. So it wouldn't be justifiable, So,
right.
And then,
I think if you went to a slaughterhouse and swapped all the cows that are crammed into that slaughterhouse in line to go to the grinder, and you put those all as people, it'd be a pretty gruesome looking sight.
You could say that's accurate. Yeah,
probably worse than the Holocaust.
I think you would say that's right. I mean, I think there's, the scale of industrial farming and the kind of distance of its reality from the reality that's on the picture of the milk carton or, whatever it is of a happy farm there. The distance there is fairly great.
Yeah, or like a chicken farm where they chop the beaks off.
Exactly,
and throw the chicken.
Yep.
And then you just get a chicken nugget and it's a deliciously breaded fried thing.
Yep.
You're out of touch with that.
Yep. Yep, exactly.
Yeah.
And there are, other arguments that when we're looking at, you don't necessarily need to value a chicken as high as a human to say that this is actually a massive problem. And I think effective altruists are going to look at that, in a sense of, how do I value a chicken relative to a human? Very difficult question, obviously.
Right.
But then also, are there things that we can do to improve the lot of these animals?
Yeah.
And when we're looking at this, what are the highest impact places that we can approach this? So within the animal rights movement, for example, there's a lot of focus on chickens specifically.
Why? Because they're the most cruelly treated.
They're very cruelly treated, and also number of individuals that are impacted is so much higher. So if you kill one cow, you can eat for, you know, a year, whereas right. I can sit down and eat a chicken, you know, in a sitting if I want to, you know?
Right.
So that, yeah, they're just that, the scale of it. And if you look at the numbers, you know, the I think fish are one of the ones that people are very concerned with, just the scale. It's like trillions of fish. They don't even know how many fish we consume every year that's measured in pounds. It's just like literally a trillion pounds of fish or something.
So if it's a tiny little fish, it could be like several fish per pound.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And those are each life forms.
Yes. Yeah. And so, yeah. You know, there is a lot of, you know, there's a lot of philosophical uncertainty there. Right. And so you have to, I think, you know, ways that people will look at that is that, you know, you can think of things in ranges, or you can think of probabilities of, you know, if this, let's say, I think there's a 50-50 chance that this is a conscious being, and if it is a conscious being, this is the impact that this would have. If it's not, and then if it's not, then I would put my impact to zero, but I can still look at that on an expectations basis and make my choices based on that. So what's my expected impact? You know, I can't predict the future. I don't know the answer to all these questions, but, you know, if I'm able to assign probabilities on my beliefs, or ranges, then I can, give comparisons across multiple interventions that I might take.
If I went to an effective altruism meeting, what would I experience?
It depends on where you go. So, I mean, I think
if I went to Germany, I'd be experiencing a lot of people talking German.
Yeah, I think that's
that's one difference.
That's like, yeah. So I think, I mean, I don't know anything about the German, like, yeah, but maybe if you go to the Germany one, it's like all philosophers or something like that, you know, and they're all just talking deep philosophy. And then if you go to, you know, some other group that has a particular, you know, maybe it's just founding members or emphasis. They might be talking strictly about global poverty. If you go to another one, they might be, you know, talking 80% about animal suffering. If you go to,
right,
you know, if you go to San Francisco, they're going to be talking about technology and how
you can help in those different sectors.
Yeah, exactly.
So is it just a bunch of people speaking philosophically, kind of wanking philosophical?
Yeah, there's an aspect of that.
Or are there actual plans and organization made to help?
Yeah, so that is the primary focus these days of the movement. So some of the organizing, there's a Center for Effective Altruism.
There's actually a center.
So that's the name of the organization. Okay. Yeah. So it's a loose, central, organizing group, but there are others that it's just the largest.
Seems like this is ripe for a leader to just come in and take
over.
Oh,
they got readers. They've got leaders for sure. I mean,
really?
It's just, I don't know. One of the things I would say about it, so I get into this effective altruism thing, and I go to one of these meetups, and they're meeting at a bar, and there's a guy, Christopher Jenkins, who's running it in New York. And I go to a couple of the meetups in the bar, and it's kind of loud. It's tough to talk, you know. So he says, well, you want to, oh, I say, you know, I can host one of these in my apartment if you want. Mm-hmm. And so we start doing that, and then he kind of brings me in to try to do more planning and figure out who we can have speak and, I just started organizing from there. And I had some friends who had no idea what effective altruism was. And, I asked them, can you go around and talk to a few of these people and see if people are saying completely different, ask them what it is and see if they say completely different things or if everybody kind of, you know, is on the same page.
Right. That's important.
Yeah. And everybody basically said, you know, everybody says the same thing. It's this interesting kind of self-organizing,
philosophy.
Yeah. And I think which at the same time allows for a lot of ultimate disagreement, you know, so you have, I mean, one of the big cause areas when I went to that first meetup, somebody starts talking to me about the artificial intelligence apocalypse that's coming, and I'm like, that's what are you talking? That's not effective. That's just like we're supposed to be looking at studies of like deworming kids and stuff like that, you know?
Right.
You know, but then you listen to these folks and all right, maybe, you know, there's a pretty good point there, you know? And so while I'm not going to be an AI researcher, I think I have a lot of, I have a lot of respect for what they're doing, and I have a lot of, openness to the fact that, you know, they've looked really hard at this. A lot of people have spent a lot of time looking into this, and so yes, they're looking this is
at,
a problem.
Yeah. They're looking how AI could become a problem or how they can use AI to help the world.
A little bit of both, but I think more of a focus on the types of problems that you might have. So if we kind of looked earlier at global poverty and animal suffering, I would say a third cause area is existential risk. So the kind of idea here is, look, I can save all of the poor kids in the world. If we get hit by a comet and the world blows up, what's the point,
right?
And so they're focusing on different areas, and artificial intelligence is one that's been high profile within the movement, I think partly because of skill sets, so there's a lot of, I think the nature of the philosophy that it's academic, it's also quantitative. It attracts folks who are, kind of logically oriented, and a lot of those folks are San Francisco programmers and things like that. So
right. Well, you could say the mobile charity system that's been set up is a form of AI.
How's that?
Because it's just like they're almost the giving mm-hmm. is almost an artificial intelligence. I'm handing my money over.
There's a certain automated aspect.
It's automated, and then all of a sudden, I click the app or whatever,
yeah.
and the money goes to a person in some distant country.
Yeah. I mean, I kind of think of the benefits of the whole movement to me to start off with is like, okay, I don't have to read into all this stuff. I read 20 pages of what you wrote. All right. I think you're on top of this. Why don't you go ahead and do that?
Right, right.
And I'll just, if you tell me that's the best place to go for it. Yeah. You guys figure it out. Like I'm not going to.
So what stuff have you done, as a result of being an effective altruist?
So I'm kind of on the, earn to give. This is kind of that model where you're
earn to give.
Yeah.
A certain percentage of your earnings go.
Yeah. So, and, one of the things that, being part of the movement has kind of affected or changed for me is it's made me increase how much I've donated. So I've kind of started giving, 5% and then 10% and kind of gradually up it and kind of see where the pain starts to kick in, if any.
The pain of having less?
Having less, exactly, yeah. And so it's, it's something weird and counter. It feels very not right to be like writing that check, There's something kind of scary about it, some lizard brain thing of like, I shouldn't be doing this.
Well, because it's like deeply embedded in us to have as much security as we can.
Yeah, I think that's right.
And
yeah.
Money is security.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's right. A good example is, 1 year I was giving 20% and then I spent, six months kind of between jobs and was, looking for a gig, but I donated the same amount. So I was like, okay, now I'm giving 40% and like, okay, so I guess it doesn't hurt that bad. And so I've kind of stuck at that level. So
40%.
About 40% now. Yeah.
Wow.
And, I'm in, financial software and stuff like that. So it's
easy to calculate.
I think, yeah, first of all, I got a great app for it. Second of all, it's, it's not really, at the end of the day, what am I going to do with that money? It's like there's, I'm kind of at enough of a place where, I don't really have massive overhead. I don't have the Lamborghini that I need to, be servicing and stuff. So it's,
you're a little too young for a midlife crisis.
Yeah, I know. Like getting there, almost there.
Wow, that's impressive. 40% of your income you give away. And do you research where to give it?
So in general, not so much. In general, I basically tell GiveWell, hey, good luck guys. Like, you guys, that's kind of what I've been doing. And I added an animal charity a couple years ago, the Humane League, that run corporate campaigns to improve welfare of animal, of farm animals.
Mm-hmm. Are you vegetarian?
Yeah, you know, I'm kind of a best efforts vegan, I would say. Okay. You know, so yeah. I try to keep I try to kind of push in that direction, yeah. And
you
try
and
to keep
Tyson.
Myself out. Is that what you're saying?
Mike Tyson's a vegan too.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Awesome.
In case like I know there's like a thing with vegans, like it's not masculine or anything.
Mm.
But hey, Mike Tyson's a vegan.
Yeah, I think the Houston the Texans or something, like they had half their team vegan last season.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's definitely Brady has a whole vegan thing, although I don't think he totally is, but it's definitely
It's a word that needs to be rebranded a little bit.
Exactly, yeah. And that's one of the things I love about the Humane League is like they're kind of, they don't fit the mold of what you'd picture. I think the whole image around it is changing, and they're just kind of badasses, you know, like they're just sort of, mm-hmm. I went to one of their parties in D.C. and there was some sort of after party, and I asked somebody for a ride, and they were like, "No, what are you talking about?" Like it was like almost like just a regular party, like like weirdo. No, you can't just like get in my car. Take an Uber.
Wow, that's a surprise.
Yeah, and I just loved it because it's, you know, that whole, I think, you know, you need the Mike Tysons to be, you know, behind it to have
right.
I mean, I don't know if he's the best, you know, spokesperson for it, but yeah. There needs to be.
What do you think of, or what does a group like that think of the smart meat that's coming?
They really like it. Yeah.
They're behind it.
Yeah, very much behind it.
So smart meat is, correct me if I'm wrong, it's meat that's actually made from cloned cells.
Yeah, so clean meat, I think, is the term I've heard more often. But yeah, so it's...
That's good. It sounds less like a smartphone. So
yeah, right. But yeah, so it's made with clone cells. It's
And it's not an actual animal that's growing. You're just growing the meat parts.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's more efficient. It's safer. There's a lot of foodborne pathogens that happen in the production of meat. It's also something, you know, you have the antibacterial resistance and things like that. So there's a lot of parts of the process that are not good for us, obviously not good for the animals that you're removing by growing just the meat using this new technology.
Right. It can get rid of mad cow disease completely.
Yeah, exactly.
Right, because mad cow is caused when you... Because it usually happens in hamburgers.
Mm.
When it's like a cow
like
has...
The brain matter is like ground up in there.
Something like that.
Yeah.
Because when you eat a hamburger, you're eating... It could be hundreds of different cows.
Right.
When your skin feels nourished and glows, you radiate confidence. Osea makes giving your skin a glow up easy with their clean, clinically proven Mega Moisture Duo. This seaweed-powered duo features two of Osea's best sellers, Undaria Algae Body Oil and Undaria Collagen Body Lotion. Glow from the inside out. Get 10% off your first order with code GLOW at OseaMalibu.com. That's OseaMalibu.com, code GLOW.
Yes, which is always appetizing to think about. and then there's other innovations in that space. So, the Impossible Burger, for example, are you familiar with this?
I've heard of that. What is that?
So that's a plant-based burger that is, they've done a lot of science and research to try to figure out what is that je ne sais quoi of meat and reproduce that using plant material. So it's not
like a super veggie burger.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. It's famous for bleeding, apparently. There's some red juices in there.
So it's made from vegetables, but
yes.
It's manufactured, dare I say, to taste like hamburger.
Yep. Yeah, exactly.
Right. See, yeah. I've been a vegetarian my whole life, and it's only because I just never, ever, even as a baby, liked the flavor of meat.
Okay. That's easy then, huh?
It's easy, yeah. And sometimes, you know, you might be at a dinner table with people that aren't vegetarian, and they automatically think, oh, you got judgments about me and eating my meat?
Uh-huh.
And that's never comfortable.
Yep.
So I give that. Oh, I just never liked the flavor.
Yeah.
But I really do like the side benefit of the fact that I've really
have never killed an animal, or very rarely have.
Yeah.
I'm responsible for very little death.
Yeah.
Relatively.
Relatively, yeah. And, you know, I think that's for me when I think about, you know, veganism for me, I'm not exactly a vegan. I think one of the things I try to do, one is, I try to remove myself from the situation. In other words, it's not really about my personal purity here. This is about, you know, how can we move from this food system that's awful to something that's good. And so I think the levels of the cost associated with improving the lives of farm animals is really so low on an individual basis that, you know, if I'm spending a whole bunch of time removing that last creamer from a coffee at a conference, you know, I should just go out there, make the money, donate it, and move on.
Right. That would be more effective.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. I think the other thing is that it's actually very hard to live purely in a purely vegan way. So, you know, if you think of, just tillage for a farm that makes grain, there are a lot of rodents and animals that are being ground up in that process,
right.
As well as, you know, land that's being dispossessed, animals dying that way. So it's really, you know, you can't live a perfect life. You know, you're just trying to get kind of closer. Right?
Yeah, you get closer. It's not like that argument. Well, then you're doing that, so you might as well not do anything.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a stupid argument.
Yeah.
So, what can I do? What is this mobile system called?
Well, so that organization is called Give Directly.
That's the name of it.
That's the name of one of the charities that that GiveWell recommends.
Okay.
So I would recommend go to GiveWell.
One word.
Go to Animal Charity Evaluators.
Okay.
And so those are places that you can donate. I think another thing that is probably under publicized is that, you know, some of the biggest impact things that can be done now are for people who have the correct skill set and can fill really high demand roles within the organization, within the movement.
Like what? What would that be?
So, you know, they're very specific. So, for example, something like a food scientist.
Ooh, right.
Yeah. So, you know, there's a lot of times you go to this job board, it can be a little bit, the skills are very specific, right? So you're like, oh, great, 8 new jobs posted. Let's go take a look. And it's like, okay, food scientist, industry lobbyist, you know, like it's like all these like really like specific and unique things. And they, you know, they change based on what's needed.
So is effective altruism, are they have lobbyists as well?
No, I don't know what the, do they have lobbyists? So there is a criminal justice reform project. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure the extent to which they've either used lobbyists or made grants to organizations that, you know, their primary activity might be lobbying. But I would say they're not averse to, using political, you know, making impact in that way.
Yeah, you can make a big impact that way.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, one of the things they would want to see is, you know, they're typically picking off some sort of underfunded, invested in type of, cause. So if they are, you know, if they are hiring a lobbyist, they're not going to, the lobbyist is, it's unlikely to say, you know, I want a higher marginal tax rate, just because, you know, there's just so much activity going on in that space.
Right. It wouldn't be the most effective.
Exactly. Like, you know, whereas if you say, you know, I want to do something for, you know, women offenders on nonviolent drug charges in this specific state because there's an election coming up or there's some sort of process that we can, you know, that's the kind of level of detail. And
right.
And
so this is probably why you tend to find more intellectual, intelligent people, dare I say, as part of this organization.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's, yeah, I mean, I think there's certainly, I think that folks have found effective altruism, you know, through, and it's, you know, so there is kind of a filter or a self-selection that takes place. Mm-hmm. I don't think of it as a, you know, like snobby kind of group or anything like that. I just think it's like the folks who have, you know, typically there's, so you're someone who's reading a bunch of blogs and you've come across this thing on the internet and then you start reading about this thing and that thing, you know, so it's just, you know, it's just a little removed from playing Fortnite all the time. I don't know. It's like, yeah, so there's a little self-selection there. Yeah.
So is there a solution to the baby drowning in the puddle?
I could put you in touch with someone who could go on for hours and hours. I mean, I think, you know, I think there are a couple of solutions. So one is, that example is, probably dated. So if we look, if we're looking at actual cost to save a life, I think GiveWell estimates right now that it's about $5,000 to save, save a life in the developing world. There are other knock-on benefits and there are different interventions that, that you would have to choose between to say, do I care more about improving the lives of people who are here, or do I care more about saving someone who would die otherwise?
Right.
So there are trade-offs, you know, in that space. So, I mean, I think
that's aside, tricky.
Yeah, it's a tricky. This is basically the solution, you know. I think, but I mean, I think there are two ways you can either approach it. You know, I think you can say, okay, we do have a responsibility to do something about this.
Right.
Or I think you can say, we don't ultimately have a responsibility to save that drowning child, in the pool. Mm-hmm. Although I'm positive philosophers have come up with 15 different flavors of each of those, you know, so, but yeah, you have to square it off somehow there, right?
Yeah. Cause this really does create quite the conundrum.
Yeah.
Especially when you're thinking, oh, I might want to get a new phone.
Yeah. Exactly.
It just creates a lot of guilt and thought.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I mean, I think one of the things, I don't think this is the real state of the world, but it's sort of a thought experiment that I have with, it's like, okay, so you wanna do that. All right, I'll just get money. I'll give it to charity. Okay, what charity should I give it to? And then you go down these things, then you start off by saying, oh, these charities are stupid, you know, and then, you know, I'm going to give to these better charities, but then you find out, well, if I just, you know, make a good web page, then I can attract more donors, you know? And then it's like, well, you know, the really big donors are like these ultra rich foundations. And so maybe if I throw a little money to like US education, they'll really plow some big money into the other thing. And you know, one of the kind of, so just as a thought experiment, it's the idea that, you know, effective altruism might eventually just look like the Red Cross, even, you know, even though we're like, the Red Cross is not the best order, but then maybe after you go through all these steps of political influence and all of these things, you say, oh, actually the Red Cross is the best thing to do, you know?
Right.
Or, I don't think that's really this, you know, the state of the world, but you can see how like that simple experiment starts to get very complicated once it touches reality.
Right. On a positive note, if you are feeling some guilt about saying wanting to upgrade your phone,
mm-hmm.
you could say, okay, well, I am going to do this for myself. I'm going to upgrade my phone, but with that new phone, it's going to be faster, mm-hmm. more efficient. I'll be able to accomplish more.
Yeah.
And therefore I can give more.
Yes. Yeah. And I think that's a healthy way to think of it. I mean, I think if you frame it as an opportunity, that as opposed to a guilt type of thing, but you basically have the opportunity that people have given this idea that if you were to save a child from a burning building or something like that, you know, that would be the greatest accomplishment of your life. You know, you kick down the door, you come running out with the child.
Right.
You know? And basically all of us have the ability to do that and for, you know, fairly short money. You know, if you were to give, you know, let's say it's $500 a year, 10 years from now, you would have done that. And that would be something that you would accomplish.
You saved a life.
You saved a life.
$5,000.
Exactly. And those numbers are, you know, subject to...
Of course.
You know, whatever.
Some lives are more valuable than others.
Just read... You're going to want to read the... Yeah, there's about 180 pages of blog posts you're going to want to read to get the full, you know, the fully asterisk and qualified version of that. But yeah, no, there are great opportunities out there to do a whole heck of a lot with not a ton of resources.
Well, I like this philosophy because it is a good thing to think about if you did want to buy yourself stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you want to buy a nicer car, for example, okay, well, then you could use that nicer car to travel further to give to somebody, mm-hmm. or maybe you'll get to your destination faster or whatever.
Yeah.
So it's a good kind of give and take.
Yeah. And I think another thing is, you know, if you're looking at this, I think people have done this where they say, I'm going to live on rice and beans and I'm going to be a banker. And then if you wash out 3 years later, then that was kind of a false economy, right? It's you didn't really save anything by buying the rice and beans if you were, if you had a nicer apartment or you chose a career that was more suited to you, then you actually could have done more, made more impact over a longer term.
Right.
So I think there's, you can take these things to extremes. And I think a focus on the highest impact things that you can do and doing those mm-hmm. is the important thing, and not to get bogged down into like, oh man, like this, so much bad in the world and like I'm a bad man and
right, cause
I'm going to go to happy hour and
drink like, my guilt away.
Like, but then I'm spending more money and then, oh no.
That's ineffective altruism.
I don't think that works in the long term. Yeah.
Right. Wow. This has been inspiring. And I personally want to thank you for giving 40% of your income. That's very admirable.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Yeah. And for the lives that you probably have saved a couple lives right now. So thank you for them.
Well, I would say definitely folks, if they, folks should look up 80,000 Hours, I think would be a great organization. Mm-hmm. There are some people for whom it makes sense to go and, do that earn to give and donate money. Right. I think that the 80,000 Hours, the concept is that in your career, in an average career, you have 80,000 hours. And so, this site is targeted to kids who are coming out of school. They're looking at what to do with their whole career over their whole life and making, decisions that can be really of massively high impact. And so I would definitely I would definitely want to highlight that focus that for, folks who are, have specific skill sets or folks who are, getting out of school and looking at things to do, that's a great resource they can use to look. And maybe it is become a banker and give all the money away, but maybe it's, become a food scientist and figure out the next clean meat thing. So
yeah, there's a lot of opportunity. And I do feel like the culture is leaning a bit more altruistic in general.
Yeah, I think that's right.
The next generation seems a little bit more aware of where their dollar is going. They mm-hmm. want to support better companies, buy better products.
Yep. Yeah. And I think there's a global, there's more of a global perspective these days. I think people really are able to see stuff from all over the world and get, it's at your fingertips to get all this information about what's happening.
Yeah.
Not just outside your door.
Awesome. Thanks so much.
Hey, thanks for having me.